Ladies and gentlemen,
this is Gamertag Radio.
Welcome to a brand new episode here at Gamer Tag Radio. We have a special guest. Look, we have this, I think, the third time we had Robbie Bach here before. I can't quite remember. But, hey, one of the original founders from Xbox that I'm about to turn 25 years old next year. It is insane.
That is how crazy.
That is crazy, right?
It is
crazy.
Yeah,
so, Robbie, welcome back. I know we're going to be talking about his – is this your third book, right? Third book?
It's my third book, second fiction novel.
All right. Third book, The Blockchain Syndicate. So we're definitely going to talk about that and, of course, some gaming stuff, some industry changes and all. So let's see what Robbie has to say about it. But, Robbie, welcome back, man. It's been a long time. How you been?
It's good to see you, Danny. It's great to be back. Love the industry. Love just getting a chance to chat.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, Robbie, can you believe it's going to be 25 years, Xbox?
It's... Well, I have multiple reactions to that. One, oh my God, I am old. That's my first reaction.
We're both up there. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, the second reaction is a little bit along the lines of, okay, new stuff, lots of change, all those kinds of things. But it's a bit of the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? I mean, it's still about creativity. It's still about characters. It's still about community and competition. A bunch of stuff has changed the same. Now, a lot of the technologies and the things behind it are all different, but some things just don't change. It's actually been cool seeing the industry grow up into something just way bigger.
Yeah, because I remember when you guys launched Xbox, it was very different when it comes to like competing and promoting the product. It was only the console. There was no, hey, buy our games on PC. I could play Xbox games on PlayStation and Nintendo devices. Like, how weird is that for you? You know, seeing that how much has changed when it comes to like before it was exclusive and now going multi-platform now.
Well, the biggest thing is it reinforces for me what has always been the truth in almost all forms of entertainment, mm-hmm. which is in the end, it is about the content. And, you know, in our industry, it's about the games. And mm-hmm. we reached a conclusion pretty early on that the console was a vehicle and people were going to buy the console they needed to play the game they wanted to play. And I think that is now more true than ever. People don't think about, PlayStation, Xbox, PC, Nintendo. I mean, there's a few things that are specifics. Nintendo titles are really Switch titles. It's hard to get away from. But mm-hmm. generally speaking, people look and say, what games do I want to play? What's cool? And they find a way to play it. And it's easier than ever. So in some ways, it's more customer-oriented and more gameplay-oriented than it's ever been.
Yeah, well, actually, I had this conversation multiple times with my co-host, Paris Lilly. Shout out to him. He also brought this up. He's like, this generation, they don't really care much about the actual just one platform. For them, it's more about the software, the games, where they could play it. Do I have access to play those games now on this device? You know, I think it's making it easier than before. Before, you had to like buy the console, then buy the games, you know? So it's very different now, right?
Well, yeah. You know, we used to say there were PlayStation fanboys and Xbox fanboys, and I guess mm-hmm. I should say fangirls as well. But mm-hmm. you know, the truth is, I'm not sure people think that way anymore. I think they think about the title that they want to play and maybe the service they're on, because I think the services still matter some, and where you meet your friends and where you go to play. Uh-huh. But I suppose there's still Sony bigots and Xbox bigots out there. But mostly, I just think people want to play great games and they find where the great games are.
Mm-hmm. When do you notice that change was coming on Xbox? Do you think it was during the days that you were there, or it was, you know, recently now, the past couple of years?
Well, I will tell you, the year I left, so that's 2010, we wrote sort of a management team memo, and the title of the management team memo was Three Screens in a Cloud. And what that meant was three screens: phone, PC, television, cloud service. And so that was in 2010.
That's a long time ago.
That's a long time ago. So it doesn't mean that the console goes away because, you know, the network hasn't advanced as much as we'd like. And so, you know, there's still connectivity and latency and all those kinds of things. But it was sort of indicating the direction we were going and the value add that Xbox Live, in our case, provided over anything else.
I know you worked with Phil Spencer. You from way back.
Still friends.
You still talk to him still?
Oh, I talk to Phil all the time.
What you think, like, you know, him as, you know, as an exec now, and it's since, what, 2014 or so, how much do you think he's been, you know, how's he been doing, do you think, the past couple of years, of your opinion?
Well, look, I think Phil, first of all, I think he's an amazing leader for Xbox. He was the right guy in 2014. He probably was the right guy when I left in 2010. I just didn't know that. I wasn't smart enough to see it. But he's the right guy for the business. And the reason he's a right guy is he is this really cool combination of technical, right? I mean, the guy was a developer, a gamer. He loves games and he plays games all the time. And a great leader. You know, you don't see that combination all that often. And so when you get that all in one package, you know, I think Microsoft's done a great job. Phil has done a great job. And, you know, he's really, you know, been a leader in the industry now for quite some time.
Yeah, and you're right. He always plays. I always see him online playing something all the time. You know, so
it's not always Xbox games, right? I mean, he'll play stuff.
He plays
on
everything.
Switch.
Yeah,
he plays everything. He wants to know what's going on in the industry, and I think that gives him a credibility that other people can't carry.
I 100% agree with you on that. Now, another thing, it looks like, you know, Xbox is really pushing this handheld with the ROG Xbox Ally that's coming out next month or so. I know back in the days, you guys had conversations. I remember hearing these rumors back then about the X-Boy, and
it never
happened, you know. But why you guys weren't ready at that time, and what do you think of Xbox now getting to the handheld business now?
Well, I could really only comment on that time. I honestly, I don't know enough about what they're doing coming up here to have an opinion. I get to see things when everybody else does, so I don't have a good opinion about that. But
yeah,
at the time when we were doing it, first of all, at that time we were just getting the team and the capability to do Xbox well, and it turns out that adding another platform, like handheld at that time, wasn't a complementary platform. It was just another thing. And so that's a new team, new hardware, new software, different development environment. It's just a whole new business. And we were struggling to get to scale on the thing we were doing, which was plenty difficult as it was. And I am a massive believer in focus. And so to me, at that point, oh man, did we need to focus on making sure Xbox and the things we were doing on Xbox and our games was really humming. And we were just getting to the point where we thought that was possible. Now, look, Microsoft's in a different place now. You know, they have a huge studio environment. Think about all the studios they have now and the content they have. So my premise, you know, who am I? I don't know a lot about what they're doing, but my premise is how many places can I put that content? That's how they make money. That's how they create fans. That's how they're successful. And so if this is another place to put the content, that's a good thing for them.
Yeah.
And a good thing for gamers.
Do you think it's smart for Xbox to acquire Activision and Blizzard? Because I know you guys worked with Activision, you know, releasing Call of Duty on the platform at that time. But now that's all, like you said, it's all Xbox now. They have a really big portfolio of games. I guess it's crazy, you know, compared to back in the days.
Well, I think rather than judging the financial viability of it, because, you know, 70 plus billion is a lot of money, and I don't know enough of the details financially to really have an opinion. I will just say, look, this is about content. And it is the clearest and most important sign that the industry is even more about the games than it's ever been before. And for Microsoft to make that kind of commitment to games and agree to publish some of those games on other platforms, right? I mean, they made an agreement to do that. Just tells you that it's about fans and what they want to play, and not actually that much about the hardware anymore.
Yep. I remember being at that E3 2006, Peter Moore was on stage and, you know, talked about Grand Theft Auto and all these other games. And I remember seeing Gears of War for the first time playable. I was like, oh my God, I have Gears of War now on my PlayStation 5 years later, you know, and it's been great. Like I purposely did that on purpose. I was like, I wanted to play this game on a PlayStation device with my friends. And it was a smooth experience. It was great. We had a good time. I actually played with my wife too, you know? So like, yeah, it's weird. It is weird seeing all these changes, but I understand why. Like you said, it's all about the content, getting the games out there to a new audience that never experienced Xbox games, you know? So well, I think it's the right move, but.
Yeah, and here's the other thing I'll just point out just as a business guy, because that's mostly the way I think about these things. The hardware is a bad business. It's just, you don't make any money.
I mean, so you're losing more money. You're losing more money than, okay.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you make a little bit of money. Maybe Nintendo manages to figure out a way to make a little bit of money. I don't know. You know, it's a really hard business. Mm. There's a reason why there's only three guys doing it, right?
That's true.
For the fourth and fifth guys looking at it going, well, that's going to be really, really hard. I don't have that kind of money. So I do think there's a tendency to say, okay, where's the real beef, and the real beef's with the games.
For you, what was your proudest moment out of the whole 25 years, you know, working back in the early days at Xbox for you?
That's a really good question. You know, if I think about my time at Microsoft, you know, I was part of the marketing team and the leader of the marketing team, ultimately, who brought Office to market. So there were some launch events for Office that were pretty amazing. In the Xbox case, let me back up. If you ask the original Xbox team, when did you know we were going to make it? You'll get different answers from different people. Ed Fries will tell you, oh, it's when we were in Times Square launching the original Xbox. I wasn't so sure then. The time I knew we had made it is when we're on stage at E3. I think this is 2003. Might have been 2004. I get those years confused. 2003. We're on stage, and Electronic Arts has agreed to join Xbox Live. And I'm standing on stage with every one of their sports cover athletes, and Muhammad Ali comes on stage.
I remember that. That was a very important moment.
To me, that was like, okay, we're here. And we're here to stay. And yes, we have challenges. Yes, there's a lot more to do. We haven't launched Xbox 360 yet, so you can't see that coming yet. Mm-hmm. But I just felt like that was the moment. And that was immensely gratifying. You know, I don't try to see personal wins in any of this, because this is all team effort. But for me personally, standing on stage there, you know, ironically, I'm on stage with Don Matrick, who's at Electronic Arts at that point, and Don eventually, you know, came to work for me for a number of years. It's just a really cool day.
Yeah, and it's also exciting how you guys also changed online gaming back in those days too, you know, which was very, very different. Like I remember, you know, Sega did their thing with Sega Dreamcast, but I think you guys figure it out from the beginning, having that Ethernet adapter there, including into the console, and also having the hard drive into the console instead of buying a memory card back in those, you know, before that. You know, I think you guys completely changed that, you know, back in those days too.
Well, what the thing I constantly remind people is I constantly say, okay, the year is 2001, 2002. How much online gaming is being done? Truth is, not that much. Mm-hmm. How easy is it to find somebody in an online game? Truth is, not very easy. Does broadband even work? The answer is, in 2001, we forget, broadband did not work well. A lot of people didn't even have broadband. So, and then you say, well, when does, you know, social networking start? And everybody says, well, it starts with Facebook, or maybe if they're really, they say MySpace, if they're whatever. You know, we were back in the days, you know, there were net servers at the time Xbox launched. That was social media. I mean, it just was CompuServe was social media. I mean, think about that for a minute. And then Xbox Live comes out. It is social, a social environment. You can talk to people. You can meet people. Broadband starts to pick up. People start designing games for broadband and for multiplayer online. And now we take that completely for granted. It's, you know, and ask yourself, how many subscriptions did you have in 2001? And the answer is you had a subscription to Time Magazine and Newsweek. Mm-hmm. Think about how many subscriptions you have now. It's an interesting retrospective. And, you know, if I have to say, how did you guys participate in changing gaming? That's what I would point to.
But were you there when Netflix launched on the Xbox 360?
Because
like the first time ever for a console to have a platform an app like that including into the console. And I remember it was an exclusive, I think, for like a year or so.
Yes, that's
you guys. Right. But that was honestly a game changer. Seeing that, like, oh wait, I could watch movies on my 360. This is exciting. You know, like streaming. You know, that type of thing. So, how much do you think that's changed from like those days to now seeing everything access everywhere, you know?
Yeah, this is all part of two things that have changed dramatically. One is the persistent presence of broadband data access. So that has changed. That's a technical way of saying that has changed almost every entertainment context we have. And then the second thing is this context of subscription services. The third thing is this context of social interaction. And all that changed in that 2001 to 2005 timeframe.
Was there anything that you regret that you're like, man, I should have done this differently?
Oh, look, we don't have that much time on your show to cover that.
But at least in this one, like highlighted, like, oh man,
There are so many things I would do differently. And they're mostly at a team leadership perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not, you know, if the team had one thing to do over again, we would have worked harder to get Grand Theft Auto on the first version of Xbox, right? For the first version of Xbox, not having Grand Theft Auto was, you know, a huge challenge for us. And it wasn't like we didn't have opportunities to have it. So you'd look at that and you say, you know, we weren't as open to that content and that title as we should have been. You know, I wish in the first version of Xbox, I'd let the technical teams run the technical part of the business instead of them looking to me to make decisions. I'm not a technical person. So there are things like that. And you know, you could go on and on about those. You could go on and on about those.
You know, one moment I feel like I think it was also a very important moment was when I think it was you that gave it the okay, let's delay Halo 2 at that time. Was it you? Was it somebody? Who was it?
Well, I mean, ultimately, I suppose I had to make those decisions, but that was really Ed Freese's call.
Ed Freese,
I mean, he ran the first party studios, and he just said, "Look, this is what we have to do." And by the way, nobody else on the management team was happy with him about that. And Ed and I had some back and forth about that, but you know, it was the right decision. I will tell you one other thing I regret. You'll laugh at this. Yeah. I regret at our first. This was in 2001 before the console's launch. I regret trying to turn the console on at our press event. Have you ever watched that video?
Wait, where? At the Times Square?
No, at E3. So
E3.
That's the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to me in my life.
You're like, whoops. And then, you know, but it was back then, it was demoing a game or a product was very different back then. It was live.
Come on. You turn the thing on and then somebody from Electronic Arts gets up and they've got a pirate game they're showing. And the only thing they could show is the ship running into the rocks. I mean, it was just that whole event was just so bad. Oh,
it was great.
Good memories. Now,
yeah. So let's go very quick. I know we don't have that much time, but let's go talk about your new book. Now,
sure.
First question I have though.
Yeah.
What makes this one different than your first book? I know your first book was about Xbox Revisited, I believe that was the name, right?
Yeah.
I know it's that and fiction books, but yeah, go ahead.
So the first book, Xbox Revisited, is a nonfiction book. That's a business and civic strategy book. It tells the Xbox story, but it's in the context of strategy. And then in 2021, I released The Wilkes Insurrection, which is fiction. And that is a contemporary thriller. It features a woman named Tamika Smith. That is what I would call sort of a techno-political thriller. Book got great reviews, really proud of it. And so the book you just held up, The Blockchain Syndicate, is a sequel to The Wilkes Insurrection. So Tamika Smith is in the book again. It is also a very contemporary thriller about what's going on in our country and our world today. I discovered with that first book that I love to write, and nonfiction seemed kind of boring. So I decided to challenge myself and write fiction. I really love doing it.
Yeah, I know, and this all relates to all the books too. Like, I know some people will say, oh, you know, why Robbie gets political and this, you know, adding to talk about the business or whatever. Why do you think it's so important to add, to mix both and also be part of the book in all three books?
Yeah, like, this is the world we live in. Mm-hmm. And this is the world that's important. You know, to me, if you're going to be engaged, if you're going to be civically involved, and I'm a big fan of being civically involved, you know, you have to face these tough issues. And, you know, in the book itself's not political in the sense that it doesn't, you know, it's not like a shame these people or shame those people or pick left or pick right or one of those things. In fact, it quite the opposite. But that's the world we live in. Those are the challenges we face. I think about my kids' generation and I say, okay, well, this is what you're going to be dealing with. And, you know, we can't run from. So what I've tried to do in the book is create something where at the end of the book, you read it and say, wow, I couldn't put that down. That was a great thriller. I love the characters. It was well written. And then I want in the back of your head to go say, oh, wait, maybe I learned something. And it's not, the inverse would be, I'm going to pound something into your head, oh, it's a fiction book. The books are written in the reverse. If you want to read them just as pure fiction, you will enjoy them and love them as pure fiction. And I just hope that I sneak a few ideas into it that make you think as well.
What made you get into that, to start writing like this, what, you know, before your first book?
Well, the first book, all of this started when I left Microsoft. I wasn't intending to become a writer. I was going to go off and do some nonprofit work, which I continue to do. That's where I spend most of my time. Mm-hmm. But then I started seeing what was going on in the country. And, you know, to be honest, it kind of pissed me off. There was a lot of non-productive activity that wasn't making our country better. So I wrote this like 12-page document, which is perfectly the length to make sure nobody reads it. It's not long enough to be thoughtful and it's not short enough to get people to read it. That led to the first book. And when I wrote the first book, I said, God, I really like this writing thing, but I want to challenge myself. I want to do something new. And by the way, I want to give people something that they enjoy. I don't want to write these sort of didactic, you know, pound ideas into your head books. That led ultimately to The Wilkes Insurrection, and Tamika Smith, who is, you know, my alter ego in many respects. I mean, she's not like me at all, but she is the vessel in which so much goes. And she's a really cool character.
So what inspires you to create this character?
Well, when I started The Wilkes Insurrection, I didn't know even that I was going to write a thriller. I just said I was going to write fiction. So I wrote 100 pages about five characters, literally a day in the life of these five people. And Tamika Smith was one of those. And when I got to the end of that, I looked at it and said, wow, the coolest person here, the one that has the most interest, flexibility, challenge, the one who's morally compromised but has deep moral convictions, she's got real challenges in her life, is Tamika. And so I started to center the book around her and have continued to do that since.
Well, was there anything, you know, that you've learned from the past, you know, working in the video game business that you added into the book, into these stories to like, hey, you know what? This will be perfect for this character or maybe the main character, anything like that?
Well, the thing I, it's very funny. The thing I have done is there's, in both books, there's a strain of technology that runs through both of them. So the dark web plays a role in all of these things. There's a
white hat hacker named Bryce Roskovich, who is a very cool character. He's a gamer on his in his own time for sure.
All right, gamer.
but he's a deeply technical guy, and he supplies support behind the scenes for the good guys in these books. So there's a deep strain of technology in it. The other thing I took from the video game industry is storytelling. Right. If there's one thing I learned from my time on Xbox, it's the power of the story. Mm-hmm. And I tried to bring that to my books. And I think the stories are really cool and the characters that go along with them.
Do you see yourself having this as like a live action thriller too in the future?
Well,
or just go strictly books?
I would love for that to happen. I think Tamika on screen would be amazing. And I think it would be, they would be a powerful show, probably more a, you know, 8-episode annual series more than a movie. But as you may suspect, that whole process is a whole nother.
That's a different ballgame.
It's a different ballgame. As my dad used to say, a kettle of fish. That's mm-hmm. just a whole nother thing. And it's really hard to figure out. But, you know, if the right person came along and said they were interested, you know, if somebody who I respected came along and said, hey, let's do this, I would absolutely do that because I think it'd be a good thing.
I think it'd be
great entertainment too.
What was one of the things that you have learned working on these two books?
Here's the thing I think that strikes me whenever I'm writing these books mm-hmm. is really trying to understand what's the character capability or character traits of these characters and where do character flaws come from? And I will tell you honestly, as I write all these different characters, both good guys and bad guys, I find being myself more introspective about my own character and my own traits and my own strengths and my own weaknesses. So in the process of that writing, I have learned a lot about myself, and I'm not in any of these books, right? So there isn't somebody in here who's Robbie Bach undercover, but yet I find myself looking in. I will say the other thing I've figured, and this won't come as a surprise, is how fragile our system is. And I say that in many different ways. Our security system is fragile. Our safety system is fragile. Our democracy is fragile. You know, we're a great country, and yet the challenges are really tough. And I see that fragility all the time as I write. And, you know, without getting too serious, the books are really fun and engaging. But they are about that fragility and how somebody who really wants to be a bad person could take advantage of it.
And how do you think we could solve it? How we could help make a change for the better?
Well, I'm writing, if you follow me on LinkedIn, I've started a series of letters on this. I've written two of them. The first one was a letter to my parents, and the second one was a letter to my kids. And I'm starting to talk about how we get the country to be better. My next letter, which probably come out later this week, early next week, is a letter to baby boomers, which is my generation, and what we need to be doing. But the biggest thing is we have to find leaders of character. And the problem isn't that we don't have leaders today. I mean, there are people in leadership positions. But without being political, Democrats or Republicans, whatever your view is, the people are not of as high character as they need to be, and they don't put their country and the people they work for first, and they put themselves mm-hmm. first. And consistently, that leads to bad outcomes. The truth is, I do a lot of policy work. We do not have a policy problem. There are solutions to the problems we have in our country. Mm-hmm. I'm convinced of that. The problem we have is a problem of will and a problem of character and a problem of leadership. And, you know, that's not easily solvable, but it takes each one of us every day sort of stepping in to do that. That sounds a little preachy, but you asked the question. That's sort of where I go.
Yeah. And you're passionate too about it. You know, and I see your posts, you know, and actually the past conversation we had, you've always been super passionate about this stuff. So I think it is important to have the conversation, you know. But I was going to ask you, and it relates to this in a way, but you know, with everything that's going on now, especially like with tariffs and all that, you know, just recently, actually twice this year, Xbox announced price increase multiple times now because of that, you know, and Nintendo, a couple other companies are PlayStation, same exact thing, you know, and this more on the gaming side, because I know this, we could talk about other things too, but as a gamer, you know, seeing that, it kind of sucks because it's, you know, as a fan of games, now I have to be really selective on what are the things I'm going to buy, you know. Just yesterday, Xbox announced the price of the new handheld, and I saw the price. I'm like, ooh, that's a little too high for me, you know. So like I'm okay with it, but I understand the situation. So like, you as a business person, like, what are your thoughts of seeing that? Of because of the tariffs and everything, just the price is just increasing like crazy, you know, nowadays.
I think again, staying away from the pure politics of it, we've run the tariff experiment before multiple times in our country, and it's failed every time. Mm-hmm. It drives prices up. Consumers are the ones who pay the bill. I'm an economics major in college. It didn't take me many classes to figure that out. And so what happens is, in various and different ways, extra cost, extra price is going to seep into everything we do. And we may collect tariff money on the one hand, but the people who are ultimately going to pay for that are ourselves. And, I think that slows the world down. You know, now do I feel like we should produce more goods in the U.S.? Yes, there's other things we should do to bring more manufacturing to the U.S. and more production to the U.S. I actually support that. I just don't think tariffs are the right tool to do it. And it is going to lead to higher prices. It'll take time, but that's going to happen. It's going to seep into everything we have in the system. I own a small gluten-free pasta company with a friend of mine named Menini's. And, you know, Menini's gets its flour to make our pasta from Canada. Now, thankfully, for reasons I don't understand, our flour is not subject to any tariffs yet. But if that happened, we'd have to raise prices on all our products. Just fact. Mm.
And there's businesses that shut down because of it, too.
Absolutely.
Which sucks.
It's not good. I think it does create some challenges. It's a big experiment, I will say that.
Yeah. Robbie, before we wrap this up, man, what is it that you want people to remember you, man? Like, you know, I know you've been in the industry a long time. Years from now, what is it that you want people to remember you when it comes to that?
The thing I think about when I think about that is I don't actually honestly think about Xbox. I don't actually think about my time at Microsoft. I actually think more about the 25 years I've worked with Boys and Girls Clubs of America. I think more about the work I'm doing with Habitat for Humanity right now. I think more about the work I do at the Bipartisan Policy Center. I think about the ways in which I've tried to give back and lift up and help other people. You know, I always tell people that, you know, Bill Gates will be remembered more for the Gates Foundation and what he and Melinda have done through their giving than he will for what he did at Microsoft. And I think that's true. And like, I'm not doing anything on anywhere close to his scale. I'm doing my own little individual work, but I kind of feel the same way. I want people to walk away and say, God, he really cared about things going on around him and was trying to make the community better. And if I get known as a community do-gooder, that would be a great thing.
I like that a lot, man, because, you know, I feel like a lot of us human beings, we like to complain a lot, but we don't find a solution. We don't go out there and solve it. We're always just there talking about, but making these type of moves, giving back to the community and also uplift others as people that need our support, you know, think that's important, you know? So,
well, the thing I would say to people who look at the problems and say, well, it's too big, I can't solve it. The answer is probably true. You're probably not going to be the person who's going to solve some of these issues, but you can do something locally in your own community that will make a difference. Mm-hmm. And just, all you got to do is raise your head and look around and you'll find someplace where you can help.
Definitely. Well, Robbie, Blockchain Syndicate. So when is the official date for this? Official date?
October.
And when people can buy it?
October 21st. People can buy it. Pre-order now. It's available October 21st. You can go to Amazon, go to any online site. You can pre-order it. Early reviews have been really good. I'm super excited about it.
Awesome. Wait, can you tell me what's going on here? I love this cover. What's going on here at the bottom?
All right. There's a scene in the book that takes place on a beach, a lonely beach in the north of the Netherlands. That's that beach.
Okay.
That, in fact, is a final scene in the book. And that character there on the front is meant to be ambiguous who it is, and people, readers, can figure that out as they go along.
Yeah, it has this perfect dark vibe. it's pretty cool, man. No, but congrats Robbie with the launch of the book, and good luck with everything, man. Hoping we can have you back in the future once again, once the third of the series comes in.
You bet.
Who knows?
Anytime. Keep up the good work, and appreciate you having me on.
All right, thanks a lot, man.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Gamertag Radio. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.